Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and our program jointly sponsored by the Singapore Consulate General. My name is Bridget Flanagan, and I'm a volunteer with the Commonwealth Club in the Bay Gourmet member-led forum. I also would like to welcome listeners on the radio and invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. We have with us today Cheryl Lu Lien Tan, the author of A Tiger in the Kitchen, a memoir of food and family. The best way I have to introduce the program is to just read a brief description of her memoir. By slowing down her fast-paced lifestyle to learn to prepare Tanlin Ama's pineapple tarts, Auntie Car Im's salted vegetable and duck soup, and Auntie Car Moi, and I hope that's right, pandan skin mooncakes, Cheryl embarks on a study of culinary history dotted by secret gambling dens, opium addictions, womanizing, and deep family schisms. And in the kitchen, Cheryl, a 30-something longing to reconnect with herself and the flavors of her youth, learns to infuse her New York lifestyle with the rich lessons of her Singaporean heritage. To introduce Ms. Tan, I'd like to welcome the Consul General of the Republic of Singapore, Mr. Hong Shen Chin.
Thank you, Bridget, and thank you, everyone, for that applause. I haven't really done anything to merit it yet. But on behalf of everyone at the Singapore Consulate General, many thanks to the Commonwealth Club and to you, Bridget, for caring, supporting, and hosting today's program. Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you, John. Thank you for all the good work and the excellent programs that the Commonwealth Club does. I'm very pleased to join Bridget's welcome to you and say a few words by way of introducing Cheryl, a daughter of Singapore, who is now based in Brooklyn. Cheryl is a journalism graduate from Northwestern, a former staff writer for the Wall Street Journal and InStyle magazine. Yes, I read it sometimes. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times and the Washington Post, among others. She was awarded a grant from the Singapore National Arts Council in 2011. Cheryl has spoken on memoir writing at the Museum of the Chinese in America and at the Asia Society. She's come here today, I believe, directly after a month-long period at Jurassic, and has been an artist in residence at Yaddo, as well as the Jurassic Resident Artists Program. Oh, I also have to thank Christy for driving Cheryl here today. When Cheryl told us about her visit to the Bay Area, we saw an opportunity to share with members of our host community a slice of Singaporean life seen through the eyes of one Singaporean as she embarked on a rediscovery of some of our common roots in the setting of the family kitchen. Cheryl will take the mic in a moment, but before I leave the podium, I want to express the consulate's warmest appreciation for the strong support shown by three Singapore companies to add a little more Singapore flavor to go with Cheryl's talk today. Your packet lunch of nasi lemak or coconut rice and traditional accompaniments has been prepared by a Menlo Park restaurant called Chuk Singapore Kitchen, represented by Rosalind and Dennis Lim. Dennis and Rosalind, will you stand up and take a bow? By the way, shok is a uniquely Singaporean expression that can best be translated as mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. And then some. Next, the canned drink in your goodie bag today comes courtesy of Yo's. And it's U.S. regional CEO, Mr. Cham Leong Kwek, is also here with us today. Cham Leong. Finally, another Singapore compatriot, the instant noodles, the tea biscuits, and the instant three-in-one coffee and tea mixes that are in your bags come from another iconic Singapore company, Kong Guan, represented by its U.S. marketing manager, James Parr. James? Finally, I would like to say thanks again to all the other Commonwealth Club volunteers and staff helping out. And one member of my consulate in particular, Janet, who helped get this show on the road but has now gone off on another important errand. She thought you might need the paper plate in your bag, something that I overlooked, on which to open your banana leaf packet of nasi lemak. I hope you will enjoy Cheryl's talk and your lunch, and perhaps later on your other Singapore goodies as well. So thank you. Cheryl?
Well, good afternoon. If you haven't had Kong Guan, any products from Kong Guan or Yo's, you're really in for a treat because I grew up eating Kong Guan biscuits and drinking Yo's drinks. And my mom knows that every time I cannot leave Singapore without at least buying 5 or 6 bottles of Yo's lemon chili sauce to bring back here. So, you know, that's all great. But also, I'm very thrilled that that Shook is providing the food today, because I actually recommend your restaurant to people. Wherever I've traveled for the book, people always ask me, where can I get good Singaporean food? And there are not that many places, because Singaporean food is really hard to find, done well here. So, you know, there are 2 places I recommend in New York and 1 in D.C., and Shook is the one I always direct people to in the Bay Area. So eat up. Now, you know, I always, you know, I've been speaking about this book for about a year now, and I always look around and I'm just floored by what I see, because I can't help but think, what would my Singaporean grandmother say? You know, you fancy San Franciscans wanting to hear about our family stories, about these dishes that my aunties, my grandmothers always dismissed as, you know, just sort of home cooked, so easy to put together, not fancy at all. Why should anyone care? And yet, here we all are. So I'm very excited to be here to share my story of a tiger in the kitchen with you. For starters, I feel like I should explain the title, because when my book came out last year, there were a few other books with the word tiger in the title. This one is a little bit different. It's called The Tiger in the Kitchen because I was born in the year of the tiger. For me, when last year there was a lot of talk about tiger moms and, you know, sort of what that all meant, for me it was very ironic because, you know, the whole idea of the tiger spirit being about regimenting people was not there for me at all when I was growing up. In fact, when I was growing up in Singapore, my mother always told me, you know, why did I have to have a tiger girl? So stubborn, so rebellious. You know, in China, she would always tell me, in China with tiger girls, they would always pull out one of their teeth so that they wouldn't be so fierce and eat up their husband in the future. And then she would say, you are very lucky we didn't do that with you. So, but my story really is about a journey. And it's a journey from being a fast-paced and sometimes neurotic, very career-driven New Yorker, Singaporean, to becoming a person who ended up not being so single-minded that she doesn't open herself up to other possibilities that could, you know, bring greater happiness and fulfillment in life. It was a lesson that I could only, in the end, learn in Singapore. And the book is also an exploration of where sort of that single-mindedness came about. You know, I'm not sure how many of you have been to Singapore. or know a whole lot about it. It's a beautiful island country, you know, in Southeast Asia, and it's you know, one of the tiger economies of Asia. It's very dynamic. You know, it's got a vibrant city center, shopping, etc. But in some ways, it was when I was growing up, my family was very traditional. So I grew up in a family where boys were prized and girls were kind of like, yeah, you're okay, you know, maybe you'll marry well or something. So I grew up, you know, in Singapore as a girl who didn't really want to be a girl. I wanted to be a boy because to me that seemed to represent such power in my very traditional Asian family. And that was still sort of patriarchal. Now, as you'll read in the book, my parents chose a name for me before I was born. Brandon. And then when I was born, they figured out they couldn't use it for me. You know, as the firstborn of the eldest son in a long line of first sons in a very traditional Chinese family, there had been very high hopes that I would be a boy. But the fact that my father got a daughter didn't deter him. Instead, he raised me as a son, essentially. He encouraged me to be good at math. He never let me beat him at Scrabble. And he also wanted me to be ambitious and to aim high and to never feel limited in anything that I could do. And above all, he never told me that I had to learn how to cook in order to be a good wife. So it was no surprise that I didn't want to be a girl, that I grew up avoiding all these womanly lessons that my aunties and my grandmothers and my mother were always trying to teach me. Instead, you know, whenever my mother complained that I was so headstrong because I was a tiger, I would always feel a sense of pride. You know, why wouldn't people want to be identified with tiger traits? You know, being ambitious, being aggressive, making things happen. People like that, you know, had great careers. They were remembered for, you know, things they accomplished in their work life. They didn't spend their lives staying at home making braised duck for their families. So my father's lessons stuck with me, pushing me to apply to college here in the United States when I wanted to be a journalist and not a doctor or a lawyer or a business person, as he would probably have preferred. And then after college, I went to Baltimore, then New York, and then where I worked for InStyle and the Wall Street Journal. But the higher I climbed, the more I felt as if something was missing. And I'd been away for about 15 years before I started to think about my grandmother's pineapple tarts. Now, if you haven't had Singaporean pineapple tarts before, they're really amazing. And there's my grandmother's recipes in the book. And I've had Americans make it here, and they testify that, you know, it's amazing. So it's not just me. But they're these buttery shortbread cookies and it's topped with dense, sweet pineapple jam that you make at home. And we serve them during Chinese New Year in Singapore because pineapples are gold, so it's a very lucky color, and it's sweet. So you know you'll go from house to house, and then you'll sample everyone's pineapple tarts, and that will be a lucky thing that you share. So my grandmother made the most amazing pineapple tarts when I was a child, and the longer I lived in New York, the more I started to think about her tarts, and they're very hard to find here. So this yearning ended up inspiring me to go back to Singapore, where I ended up traveling there over one lunar calendar year just a few years ago to ask the women in my family to teach me how to cook. And they were very surprised about this because I had spent my whole life avoiding the kitchen. I had spent my whole life avoiding anything that they could teach me. And all of a sudden, here I was, this person who had been away for so many years, coming back and finally entering the kitchen. So I'm going to read a little bit from my very first time back in Singapore. And there's a little bit of a culture shock there because I'd been living in America for so long, in the U.S., in New York in particular, and so going back to the little kitchens of my aunties, they're trying to understand me, and I'm trying to understand them, you know, things get interesting. Could I have a little bit of water? Oh, wonderful. Oh, okay, thank you. In silence we worked. My inability to speak much Teochew, our Chinese dialect, being a major social hindrance. But as we carefully dug out the 100 or so eyes that were in each pineapple, the stories emerged. My Auntie Karim, of course, began by asking the question I'd been getting since I became engaged 7 years ago. When are you having a child? My answer that I was just too busy with work, with life in New York, to even fathom producing anything that would depend on me for just about everything was unacceptable, of course. After a short silence, her sisters nudged me to take a break and eat something, gesturing to a large pot of jet-black liquid on the counter. Du ka tio, my Auntie Karim said in Teochew. stopping to explain further in Mandarin when it was clear that I had no comprehension of what she had just said. It turned out the dish was a stew of pig's trotters braised in black vinegar and ginger. Good for after giving birth, Auntie Karim said. Very easy to make. Her point was taken. When the 70 pineapples had been cleaned, prepped, and cut into large chunks, Auntie Karim began running the slices through a juicer, dumping the pulp into a massive wok and preserving the juice in a pot. Into the wok went cinnamon sticks, knotted pandan leaves from a tropical plant that's similar in scent to vanilla and is used in many Southeast Asian desserts, and a few cups of the juice. And then the truly laborious work began. For the next several hours, we sweated over the stove, stirring the pineapple concoction in several woks, pausing now and then to taste the gradually congealing jam to see if the mixture needed more sugar or juice. Actually, to be more accurate, Auntie Karim sweated over the stove. As she did the bulk of the stirring, with me pitching in now and then, I hovered with my notebook and my camera, trying to document every moment, believing that this would be the best way to ensure that I would remember every sliver of this process. Watching Auntie Karim stir with ease and calm in her mother's sweltering backyard kitchen, I felt increasingly puzzled. She looked nothing like the frazzled bundle of nerves that I was in my own kitchen, where I often found myself glued to a printed out recipe or instructions on my BlackBerry, not daring to make a move without first rereading the recipe for the 20th time. Sometimes I would attempt to be bold, but my definition of culinary bravery meant that I would first read the 150 comments on an Epicurious.com recipe for additions that other cooks had made, and then after much thought and more web research about the pros and cons of making an unorthodox move that hadn't been sanctioned by the mighty editors of Gourmet, I would make the addition, my heart filling with fear. Auntie Karim, however, displayed none of this trepidation. Instead, I watched in shock as she would sample the tiniest spoonful of boiling jam, then cavalierly slit open giant bags of sugar, hoist them over the woks, and give them a hefty jiggle, inspiring landslide amounts to tumble forth. "Wait, wait," I said. How much are you putting in? How do you know how much to put in?" These questions at first confused Auntie Karim, who immediately started laughing once she figured out what I was asking. "Aiya," she said. "Buyong measure la. Just taste, 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 then aga, aga." I didn't know it then, but aga, aga, a Malay phrase that means guess, guess, would be a refrain that I would hear over and over during the next 2 days of tart making, usually uttered following some laughter on my auntie's part over my attachment to the preposterous notion that cooking should be precise. I wasn't seeing much humor in the kitchen that day, however. I'd been hoping to learn a recipe, one that I would be able to replicate back in New York. I had never done the aga-aga thing in my kitchen. How would I know if I was screwing up? And so I attempted to grill Auntie Karim. "No, but really, how much sugar do I put in?" Patiently, she explained, "You see how sweet your pineapple is, Law? Very sweet, then add less. Not so sweet, then add more." This was very unhelpful, I thought. "But how can you tell how sweet your pineapple is? Are pineapples of a certain shade sweeter? Can you tell by their smell? If it's sweet, how much sugar do you add? If it's not so sweet, how much do you add? What is your definition of sweet?" Now it was her turn to look confused for a moment, before erupting once again in laughter. "Aya," she finally said when she caught her breath. "Just taste, 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 then aga, aga." I was starting to get truly panicked. I had traveled from half a world away in order to learn my Tanglin Ama's pineapple tart recipe. But it was starting to look like I would return to New York with vague instructions built on the nebulous foundation of aga aga. After about the fifth time that we had this exchange, however, Auntie Karim decided to humor me by measuring the sugar she was adding, while laughing at the ludicrousness of the practice. She had learned how to make the tarts and to cook from my grandmother, not by measuring, not by taking pictures or writing things down, of course. She had learned from watching, from helping, from cooking along with her. There had never been any need for words or lessons. They simply had a job to do, to put food on the table. And they just rolled up their sleeves and they did it. If something tasted too sweet or too salty one day, they would just add less sugar or salt the next. Cooking wasn't a science. It wasn't meant to be perfect. It was simply a way to feed the people you love. So that's how the journey begins. It kind of goes downhill a little bit in the book and then goes up again, I think. But you'll have to read to figure it out. It gets a little easier as it goes along. you know, once I decided I wanted to spend, after that time that I went home, it was really my first experience learning how to make something Singaporean, cooking with my aunties, cooking with my grandmother. I decided that I wanted to spend more time, you know, sort of learning more of their recipes. As I left, they said, well, you know, my grandmother who made these great pineapple tarts, the reason we had 70 pineapples was that they make 3,000 tarts every Chinese New Year. They get together and for 2 days, they make 3,000 pineapple tarts. And because my grandmother made these amazing tarts, and she died when I was 11. So, but that was many years ago, like maybe 10. I'm kidding. But even now, people still request tubs of her tarts. So that's why we make so many. But as I left, they said, you know, we have all your grandmother's recipes. Anytime you want to come back, you know, we'll teach you. We'll teach you how to make her salted vegetable and duck soup. We'll teach you how to make this and that. So I thought, well, it'd be great if I could take a year off and spend a lunar calendar year kind of hitting the major festivals, because my family is really, really fearless in the kitchen. You know, people buy mooncakes. My family makes mooncakes. People buy bak chang, the dumplings, the glutinous rice dumplings you eat for dumpling festival filled with pork. My family makes them from scratch. So all these things I felt we're kind of getting lost, because a lot of my cousins are just like me, my generation. We're very busy. We're all working. No one has the time to spend 2 days in a kitchen making something. So these recipes, I felt, were kind of getting lost. And also, along with that, the stories of my grandmothers and my aunties and my ancestors. So I spent a lunar calendar year traveling to Singapore, hitting all the major festivals, and learning how to cook with my aunties. And now, in all my years as a journalist, I've had to grill CEOs and aggressively elbow my way into fashion shows and press conferences. Having done all this, I had presumed that I was prepared for this year. But as you'll read in the book, it was a little bit more challenging than I had envisioned. I've encountered all sorts of women in my professional life, high-powered business people, politicians. But in the end, it turned out that none scared me more than my grandmother and my aunties when they were in the kitchen, because they were just so fierce and just sort of confident and had this ferocious quality about cooking. And watching them cook for over a year and learning from them, I learned a lot about them and myself in the process. And I also learned about slowing my life down to learn how to cook and to be with my family. And I learned about sort of letting a lot of the other stuff go. And it ended up being a way for me to get to know the women in my family, because a lot of times if you sit down and you try to get, you know, a story from your grandmother or your mother, you know, they're not really going to tell you a story. But, you know, if you're in the kitchen with them for an hour chopping shallots, you know, that's when the stories are going to emerge. And so I learned a lot of things about my family. I learned, you know, that my really strict Auntie Ling Ying, who was actually an opium carrier for my great-grandfather when she was a child, because who would suspect a six-year-old girl being sent out to get a basket of something, right? And I learned that, you know, my grandfathers and great-grandfather had, you know, everyone had multiple wives, and, like, you know, they were, and my family was very rich at one point and then so poor that both my grandmothers at some point ran illegal gambling dens in their homes just to make a little bit of money. But I should point out that my whole family in Singapore is on the straight and narrow now. Nobody's breaking any laws, in case that isn't clear. But, you know, through all of this, you know, I really learned sort of the resilience of the women in my family. And I'm going to read a little bit from a section where I'm kind of learning about these men that I had sort of grown up emulating, and kind of learning some things about them. So this is when I'm in my Auntie Ling Ying's house, and she's told me about, you know, just sort of being this opium carrier, you know, just sort of people scrabbling for fighting for money, gambling addictions, everything. And it just sounds like, you know, it's been this incredibly hard life, and yet one that managed to, where the women managed to hold the family together enough to give the next generation a chance, to give me a chance to come to college here and to have a life. So and you know, to sort of, you know, be a journalist and to eventually write a book. So so this is a little part from that, where she's gone through all this stuff about, like, how hard it was in Singapore, and the one thread through all of this was that food was always the thing that brought everyone together. So did you have any fond memories of your childhood at all? I found myself asking her. My Auntie Ling Ying pulled out a photo album, pointing to a handful of black and white photos, square and small, with the ornately pinked white edges of 1950s photographs. In the photos, my grandfather is in a park with his children. There's Auntie Ling Ying dressed in her Sunday best. My father and Uncle Sukiet are small and yet unformed. Both boys have pants so formal and high, they seem to end just beneath their arms. It is a starched, dressed-up moment, one unlike the many fractured moments that bind their childhood together. And yet everyone is smiling. My Auntie Ling Ying is beaming from ear to ear. My father has his "I'm smarter than all of you" smirk. My Uncle Sukiet looks mischievous. I felt relieved that there were, at least, by some appearances, happy moments. There was this one time, Auntie Ling Ying says, when my father took us all to the amusement park. We were so excited, you know. It was a family excursion. But when we got to the park, he gave your ama some money and said, go take the children around the park and meet me back at this park bench at this time. And he went his own way. That evening, we went to the park bench and we waited and waited and waited. He didn't show up. We were so scared, you know. It was so dark. We didn't know where he was. We didn't know what happened to him. And then finally, your ama said to me, go into that dance hall over there and ask your father to come out. So I went inside, and he was dancing with this woman. I asked him to come out, and I said we were waiting for him. And he just said, go, I'll meet you in a while. So I went back out, and we waited and waited until it was very late. And then finally, he came out, and we went home together. I thought of my father as a young boy, his siblings with him, his mother, so virtuous and selfless, sitting in the dark on that park bench, waiting for my grandfather, not knowing when he might emerge from that dance hall. I suddenly understood why I had never seen a photo of myself with my grandfather, who had died the year after I was born. My father would spend decades loathing him. That night, perhaps, had been the beginning. It's getting late, I said. I shouldn't bother you anymore, starting to pick up our teacups to bring into the kitchen. No need, no need, Auntie Ling Ying said. As I gathered my belongings, however, she motioned for me to wait. Uncle Paul, her husband, disappeared for a moment, returning with a flat woven basket the size of a large bicycle wheel. Your ama, when she died, gave me the millstone that she used to grind rice into flour. But I didn't have room for it, so we gave it away, she said, chagrined. But this I kept. Around this flat basket, my Tanglin ama had gathered her children, and together they had made tangyuan, the glutinous flour dumpling served in a lightly sweetened soup as a dessert or snack on special occasions. Because of its roundness, the dumpling is symbolic of unity in the family. And my grandmother used to have her children sit around the basket. Each one would be assigned a section, so each had to fill his or her section with the tiny white balls of dough. It was an activity that even my father, the firstborn son, was roped in to do. Family is family, after all. I laid my hand flat on the basket. It was cool to the touch. And I imagined my family, my Auntie Ling Ying, my Uncle Sukiet, and my father, whom I'd always believed had never cooked a moment in his life, gathered around the basket, carefully rolling little white balls, making unity dumplings, bound in a circle. So that's kind of how I learned that my father actually does cook, and he's just lazy about it. But through all these stories and through all the moments that I spent with my family, I learned a lot about sort of the resilience and the courage, and sort of having the confidence to know, you know, what is important to you, what you need to do, and to just go ahead and do it. Because I watched the women in my family tell me the stories of how they had done that all their lives. And in the time that since I've been back in the U.S. and since my year of cooking, I actually travel back to Singapore a fair bit now just because I've still, the cooking lessons continue every time I'm back there. I think of my aunties often, sort of applying those lessons that I learned to sort of forging ahead in my career and also, you know, not letting myself get, you know, too down whenever setbacks happen because, you know, whenever something bad happens, I think about, you know, what would my grandmothers do? But, you know, sort of most important, I learned in that year of cooking and through the act of making food together that, you know, sometimes it's the other things in life that provide the necessary nourishment. And just sort of being with your family, being at home, wherever that is important to make you whole sometimes. But above all, what I really learned in that year was that I had truly underestimated the women in my family all along, that they, in particular, had always had a lot to teach me, and they had always had a lot of love to give. And it made me realize that being an Asian woman in this day and age doesn't mean that you necessarily have to choose one over the other, that you ideally should have the drive and the ambition to succeed in the world at large, but it's also great if you have the time and the heart to want to sometimes spend time in the kitchen feeding the people you love. And it's a lesson I never would have learned if I hadn't slowed my life down and gone home to rediscover my family in Singapore. So I often wonder what my paternal grandmother, the legendary baker of pineapple tarts, would think if she knew me now. She died when I was so young, and food was really the only way that we communicated. She didn't speak English, and I didn't speak Teochew, and it was very difficult to communicate, but she knew that I loved her pineapple tarts and I loved her food. So whenever I went there, she would push a plate of tarts to me, and I would always have a little box to bring home. You know, I think back to how I barely knew her as a child. Her westernized, book-loving granddaughter was simply mystifying to her at the time. But in the year that I spent getting to know her and getting to know my family and rediscovering sort of my Singaporean culinary heritage and learning all the sacrifices that she made and everything she endured, immense poverty, a husband with a gambling addiction, you know, and she went through all of that and managed to put food on the dinner table for her children day after day. I'd like to think that she would be as proud of me as I have become of her. And as the year drew to an end, one of my aunties said to me, you know, they were kind of surprised that I kind of stuck it out and actually got in there and like made, you know, all these dishes that, you know, even now I'm kind of amazed that they make it regularly and I make for special occasions here. At the end, one of my aunties said to me, you know, there's an old Chinese saying, and it goes something like this, 进得了厨房也进得了大厅. My Mandarin is quite terrible, so I had to ask her, well, what does that mean? And she said, it means that you are skilled enough to be in the kitchen, but you're also skilled enough to be in the great hall. And, so I said, well, that's very sweet. And she said, well, basically it means that you're a superwoman. So that's what I took from my year of learning how to cook in Singapore. Thank you. So I guess we'll take some questions.
And then there may be some people. Do you have any keepsakes from your year in Singapore that you keep with you now to remind you of your time there?
Yeah, I learned a lot about how my relatives cook and how that's different from here. Like using these flat baskets to steam fish, you know, they'll put a banana leaf on it and, you know, steam it. So I brought back sort of utensils here and there that I kind of think about when I cook in New York, and I'll think about my aunties when I do that. I feel like I'm sort of this thread is connecting, you know, the when I cook, it's like it's connecting me to them in some way, and I do think about them when I cook. You know, I have a giant wok big enough to braise two ducks at once. I had to really explain that. I flew through Honolulu, I remember, and the guy at customs is, like, stopping me. He's like, what is this? I'm like, it's a wok. He's like, I've never seen a wok this big. What are you going to do with it? I'm like, I'm going to try and braise, like, a Thanksgiving turkey and, like, soy sauce and whatever. And he made me sit there and listen to – he made me tell him – I'm like, my grandmother makes this braised duck with, like, you know, galangal and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, how are you going to do that with turkey? And then when I explained the whole thing, he's like, all right, you can go. So the things that I kept are you know, they might seem to be kind of everyday things that people don't really, you know, think about much, but in my family, I learned that those were the really prized things. You know, the basket my grandmother handed down, and I think these are things that people kind of overlook sometimes, but you know, now I know how to treasure them.
What is the most surprising experience that you had during your year in Singapore?
I think the biggest thing for me was sort of the revelation that I had gotten it wrong the whole time, that that I had always sort of thought of my, you know, grandmother as, yeah, she makes really good tarts, or, you know, my other grandmother makes really good popiao, which is this amazing Singaporean summer roll filled with, like, jicama, peanuts, and everything. There's a recipe for it in here. And so I just always thought, yeah, they make nice food. It's great. But there's not a whole lot to them. You know, it's like, you know, it's people who, like, you know, become bankers and, like, that kind of thing that I should be kind of thinking about, and sort of realizing that I'd gotten all that wrong the whole time. So that was the biggest revelation for me, learning their stories, hearing their stories in the kitchen, you know, learning how difficult it was to put together the dishes that they were putting together on a regular basis, and just, you know, sort of my new admiration for them.
There may be some questions from the audience.
What kind of advice would you give to this modern, you know, Hello. It was actually I belong to a part of the book group here in San Francisco. I come from India, and three of us are sitting there, you know, and we read this book and we discussed this book, and it was really fascinating. Can you hear me? Yeah. So it was really a fascinating read, and I could relate a lot to this book because I was also raised by moms and grandmothers who were not literates, but they were great cooks, and then they always used to give us words of wisdom and, you know, how to feed people and how to, it is so rewarding to do it. I mean, that's a part of our culture also. Now, coming back to this era, now what kind of advice would you give to women who, I would say they look down upon cooking, but who think, you know, they think it is not so important, and, you know, feeding their kids or their family is not so important when everything is available in the stores, you know, just ready to eat, ready to cook stuff. So do you think they're missing something?
Yeah, I would encourage you to, you know, recipes are family recipes especially, I think, are very often overlooked because you eat it every day and you take it for granted. And, you know, I would encourage you to sort of, if you have keepers of those recipes in your family, go and spend a day with them, write things down, listen to them, listen to their stories, watch how things are done. There were many things that I would never have learned right if I wasn't actually in the kitchen, because my aunties, for years I'd be like, can you send me the recipe for whatever? And they're like, no, there's no recipe. You have to come and learn. And it was, I realized what they were talking about, because they're like, okay, so you look at the pot, huh? It has to be 20% cooked. I'm like, 20% cooked. And you're like, is this color? And so, you know, so it's not, unless you're there, you're not going to know. But, you know, while those keepers of those recipes are still around, you know, definitely take the time, go and, you know, spend time with them, learn how to cook. Because since this book has come out, I've gotten so many emails from readers who, a lot of them are happy, thankfully, and they have those recipes. But a lot of them are actually very sad because, like, they're thinking about that recipe that someone had who's not around anymore. And then this woman said to me, you know, my dad used to make the best sloppy joes. And, you know, and how your dad makes sloppy joes is going to be different from how someone else's dad or mom makes sloppy joes. And, you know, once that person passes on, you're not going to have that recipe anymore. So while you're, you know, while that person's still around, you know, definitely go into the kitchen and, you know, ask questions, poke around, take pictures.
Hi, Ms. Tan.
Hi.
Good seeing you again.
Yeah.
As you know, my book club also read your book. And we were curious to know, in terms of your memoir, have many of your family members read the memoir at this point? And do they feel if it's an accurate portrayal of the recipes?
I think they're certainly happy with the recipes. My cousins were very happy I was doing this because none of them wanted to be in the kitchen writing the recipes down. So they're very excited that they're like, okay, this is it. You know, we don't have to actually do it. But I was very nervous about how my family would respond to the book because, you know, being a sort of a very traditional Asian family, they're very private. But I was very clear about what I was doing throughout the whole thing, even though they kept thinking I was opening a restaurant. Because they didn't really understand what I was doing. So they're like, oh, okay, she's coming back to learn how to cook because she's opening a restaurant in New York. But it took a few months. But, like, you know, every time I left, they'd be like, tell us when your restaurant's opening. You know, send us a picture. I'm like, it's not a restaurant. It's a book. But they got it after a while. But when it came out, they actually my father was the first person to read it. And he, you know, he was very proud of it. And there were some painful things in here about his dad and, you know, his grandfather. And, you know, but it's also long ago, I guess. And I had told my family, you cannot fully appreciate the ups until you know, the downs. So I think he understood that. And also I got an email from one of my uncles who said, you know, it reminded me that I should be nicer to your grandmother. And I'm like, well, if this book has done one good thing, it's that, right? So yeah, my family's been very, very supportive. They've been really great. So, yeah, so we'll see.
I also enjoy cooking, but I'm those kind of aga-aga cook. Yeah. I don't look at recipes.
That's
maybe
the best
now
kind.
I should start collecting my grandma's recipes before she passes on. My question is, you mentioned about gambling dens. Mm-hmm. Was there any special food that your grandma made for people at the dens?
Yeah. Actually, this is one of my favorite dishes in the book. And it came about because my my grandmother, who was the legendary baker of pineapple tarts, had this gambling den at the time. And I remember I was talking to one of my uncles, and he's like, oh, your grandmother used to make this dish, bwakyeongbeung, which is gambler's rice. And I'm like, what's that? I've never thought about it before. And he's like, oh, you know, it was this amazing thing. And it turned out that my grandmother, in addition to being a great cook, was also very smart. So when she had gamblers in her home gambling, she didn't want them to get hungry and leave. So she started to cook for them. And she wanted to make something easy, so you know they don't have to stop; they can just keep going. So she came. There's this one pot, one bowl like rice dish. It's like cabbage, salted fish, pork belly, garlic, you know, shallots, everything kind of fried together and like fried with rice, and then you cook in the rice cooker. And she called it gambler's rice because you can hold a bowl in one hand and keep gambling with the other. So, I just love that story because nobody had thought to tell me that story when I was a kid because to them it's just bwakyeongbeung. It's like, yeah, let's have some this weekend or whatever. But it was just a fascinating story to me because it said so much about one Singaporean family in one moment in time and sort of the smartness of this one woman to kind of, you know, get all this done and to feed her family and to feed her gamblers. And I thought it was a lovely recipe and a story that kind of illustrated a very special moment, perhaps.
Other questions?
Okay.
I love to cook. Mm-hmm. I haven't purchased the book, but I'm going to do it after the program. How easy are the recipes, and do they require a lot of ingredients that might be difficult to find?
In San Francisco, you'll be able to find everything, I'm pretty sure. One of my events was at this little bookstore about an hour south of Chicago, and they were determined to make dishes from the book. And they actually made a four-course meal with my grandmother's dishes. And they managed to find everything. So I'm like, if in the middle of Illinois, you can find all the ingredients, you can find it anywhere. the recipes are, there are only 10 because the book is a narrative. But if you read anything in the book, I'm actually very open to emailing other recipes to people. So if you read anything in the book and you're like, the recipe isn't in it, just email me and I'd be happy to share my recipe with you. But some of them are very simple. Like my grandmother makes this amazing coconut jam, kaya, and it's only 4 ingredients. It's like sugar, eggs, pandan leaf, and coconut, and that's it. So there's some that are very simple, and there are some that are a little bit more labor intensive. But you know, make it a family activity. Like one of my favorite dishes in here, I mentioned it. My grandmother makes these amazing popiang, which is summer rolls. And we have popiang parties. So you set out the skin, you set out all the ingredients, and the kids love it because they kind of get around. Everyone assembles their own rolls. So it's a way to bring people together. So don't be afraid. And you know, you can always simplify too. Aga aga, as my aunties say. I'm currently working on my second book. It's a novel set in Singapore, and I was just at Jurassic, which is about an hour south of here. I don't know if you know of it. They have an open house coming up next month. Actually, everyone should go visit. It's a beautiful place where I was there writing for a month in the mountains and writing about Singaporean food and really kind of not Singaporean food so much, but Singaporean culture and sort of yearning for home. So I found that to be very effective. Actually, I write best about Singapore when I'm in a place where I really want to be in Singapore. I'm not allowed to say much more about it at this point, but I'm very excited about it. I think it's what I've loved about the opportunities that I've had with this book is sort of explaining Singapore culture and Singapore food and sort of the Singapore folkways and how we are to people. That's been something I've really enjoyed doing. So I hope my second book will do the same too.
Another question here.
My question was also about ingredients, which mm-hmm. I'm sure we can do well here. How about in New York? And New York kitchens are so small, generally.
My kitchen's the size of this podium. I'm not kidding.
I'm sure of that. So how do you manage?
In New York, I basically, when I have dinner parties, my entire living room gets turned into the kitchen. So, my husband is the sous chef, so he's chopping shallots for an entire day, like in the living room on the coffee table. So that's how it works, basically. My aunties in Singapore have great kitchens. Like one of my aunties, her entire backyard has been turned into a kitchen. So she has the inside kitchen, and then you kind of walk out, it's like another kitchen. So I don't have that in New York. But, you know, the recipes in here are not so intimidating. Some of them are actually very easy. So, and if anyone has any questions, I'm always very open to answering questions about ingredients or recipes or substitutes.
Are there other questions from the audience? I have one. Are you missing your career as a hard driving journalist? And do you have any plans to go back to doing the type of thing that you were doing before, or maybe integrating it into your present life and career?
Well, I do miss sort of the I do miss journalism sometimes. I miss working at the rhythm of working at a newspaper. I love deadlines, and you know, book deadlines are a little bit different. You know, your deadline is like a year from now, which is a little different from an hour from now. But I really loved having the opportunity to write my first book, and I'm really loving writing my second book. So I think for now that's where my head's at. But you know, I'll never rule things out. You know, who knows what will happen.
I would encourage people to read your blog.
Right. Yes.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your blog and photography and
mm-hmm.
subjects that you cover.
Yeah. Well, you know, I set up the blog at the same time as when I first signed my book contract, because I knew even then that there was no way I could fit all my experiences of eating in Singapore and cooking in Singapore in the book. So if you read the blog, there's actually a lot of other extra recipes and stories from my aunties in Singapore. Now that the book's come out and I'm not in Singapore so much anymore, you know, it's extended to you know, things that my friends are cooking, or when we were at Jurassi, I learned how to make Mongolian dumplings from a Mongolian artist there, and a strudel from an Austrian artist there. So the stuff like that, it goes on the blog. So it's like kind of things, food encounters that I have, you know, things that I'm eating, and you know, just sort of sometimes it's just throwing a photo of I made Singaporean satay actually at when I was at Jurassi, and it was a lot of fun. So there's a picture of my Singaporean satay on the blog. So that's kind of you know, that's what you can get there, and additional recipes as well. So check it out if you're interested in cooking or traveling. I write travel stories now too. I still freelance, so I freelance travel stories. A lot of them tend to be about Singapore for the New York Times and other places. So you know, I hope you enjoy them when you read them.
So for people who haven't been to Singapore, mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone's going, I have a list. Because since this book's come out, everyone who's going to Singapore emails me to say, where should I eat? So I have now this list that I send to anyone. So, you know, my email is just atigerinthekitchen@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to send the list to you if you're ever going. But I always tell people, if you're going to Singapore, plan on having at least 6, 7 to 8 meals a day, because that's the only way you'll manage to work through anything, make a dent in the cuisine. You know, the portions are small. You know, the best way to discover the country is to travel from neighborhood to neighborhood, eat at hawker centers. Restaurants are great in Singapore, but, you know, the hawker centers are amazing. They're like these outdoor food courts, and every stall has, like, these hawkers that they've spent like their whole lives making one dish. So that's part of the reason it's really hard. And I really admire, you know, restaurants like Shook that do it so well. That, you know, when people grow up in Singapore, what you eat is like this one guy in this one stall making like the same fried noodles 100 times a day for 30 years. There's no way you're going to make noodles as good as that guy. You know, so it's great. It's a great way to kind of discover the country. Just going around and eating. Chili crab is our national dish. It's like this crab with like fiery tomato, like chili sauce with eggs. And like you eat it with like fried like bread and you kind of dip it in there. You know, it's like this real sort of polyglot of food culture kind of meshed together. It's like Malay, Chinese, Indian cuisines kind of mixed together with Dutch or British influences. So you're not going to find you know, really good versions of that in most places unless you actually go. So if you do go, tell me. I will tell you where to eat. But you do have to be prepared to listen to me and eat 7 or 8 meals a day.
Mm-hmm. About Singapore.
Yeah.
Food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sam Sifton, it's a wonderful story, and the recipe looks delicious. It's for chili lobster, and I spoke to Sam before he ran the story, and he's a huge lover of all kinds of food and fascinated with Singapore food and a great cook himself. So I was very curious to see what he would do, and it just looked amazing. It sounded amazing, and I thought the story was great, and I can't wait to try it myself. I've never had chili lobster, so I'm very curious, but look at the story and try out the recipe. I'm sure it's great.
We have a sign-up list that was going around. I don't know if everybody got a chance to sign up. It's just to drop your email off if you would like to, so that you can receive information about upcoming Bay Gourmet events. So.
We just have a few more minutes.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. One of the things that that happened in the year was in this journey to go back to Singapore and sort of discover my cultural identity through food was that it ended up bringing me back to China for a trip, because I kept hearing about this great grandfather who came all the way from China. And as a teenager, and you know, just hopped on a boat and said, "There's got to be a better life out there." And he ended up in Singapore, where he ended up building a company and becoming quite rich. But I always was curious about where he left and how that had come about. My father and I ended up taking a trip to this tiny village. We located through the clan association, the Teochew Clan Association in Singapore, and we ended up going on this trip to this tiny little place in southern China. It's wedged between Shantou and Chaozhou, and we'd never been to that part of the country before, so we were very curious about the whole thing. And being in that village was kind of eye opening, and it made us think about how lucky we were, I guess. So I'm going to read a little bit from the China chapter. Our first meal with the villagers would be like all our other meals, filled with men and me. We entered the private dining room of the restaurant to find ourselves penetrating a plume of cigarette smoke. Michael, our guide, introduced us as fellow Tans, family from Singapore and New York. I leapt into action, firmly shaking everyone's hand and telling them my name in Mandarin, Rulian. The village chief was there, a stout, comfortable-looking man who appeared to be in his 60s but had a full head of hair that looked dyed to unnatural blackness and the belly of someone who did not want for much. He gestured for us to take a seat at the dinner table. I headed straight for the chair in a corner at the farthest end, thinking nothing of it. The meal was a several-courser, fried tofu, fish, a heaping plate of noodles. We had brought bottles of wine as a gift for the village head, so we shared several toasts. I was surprised when they poured me a glass, too, and I merrily drank along, clinking glasses with my new uncles. They spoke Mandarin, yes, but were most comfortable with Teochew, a dialect I barely understood. By the end of dinner, however, I felt like I was starting to get the hang of it. As we stood around outside the restaurant, the men embroiled in deep conversation. I nodded, listened, and smiled along. "Do you know what they're saying?" my dad asked. "They're talking about dinner tonight, right?" "No la," he said. "They're talking about what we're going to do tomorrow." I was suddenly glad I hadn't tried to say anything, not that I really would have known what to say in Teochew. In fact, my Mandarin, which I rarely speak in New York or Singapore, wasn't functioning very well either. When I wanted to borrow a pen to write something down, it was fortunate that I thought to check with my dad about the wording. I had been about to ask the village chief if I could borrow his bizi, or nose, instead of a bee. Just when I was starting to feel a little morose about the days ahead and whether I was fitting in, one of the villagers asked, "Have you heard of this phrase? Teochew nang, pa si bo xiang gang." Now, I've heard only one saying regarding Teochew nang, which means Teochew people. And it's a popular saying in Singapore. It basically means, it was Teochew nang, ka cheng ang ang. And it basically means Teochew people have red backsides. I wondered if this saying was popular in China as well, and I wondered if I should ask. But I decided it might not be the best question on the very first night. "No," I said instead, "what does it mean?" "It basically means that Teochew people, you beat them until they're close to death, but they will still survive," he said. "We're strong." I like that, perhaps not as much as my red behind saying, but I felt like I was learning something about my people, about me. In the car ride back to our hotel in Chaozhou, our driver said, "You see this car in the front? No license plate also can still drive. It was true. Among the cars madly zigzagging across the intersection, this one had absolutely no identification. Here, he said proudly, anything can happen. You want to do something, you just do it. I was beginning to like the sound of my people. It was starting to explain some things about my family and perhaps me. Shortly after, our driver slowed to a crawl. In the dusty blackness, I saw that a lorry had halted just before us. Not wanting to wait for the crowd to clear, the driver swung his steering wheel and darted around the lorry. As we slowly passed, we saw a flash of bright red and understood what had happened. The lorry had struck a girl in a red parka. Two young men had run out onto the road. One grabbed her hands, one her feet. Together, they were hoisting the wide-eyed, terrified girl like a limp doll as they hurried back to the side of the road. Our car barely missed hitting them. The next morning, the chief's son came to the hotel to give us a ride into the village. On the way there, Michael filled us in on our people. Sanitary ware is the big business here, he said, pointing to giant billboards that advertise bathtubs and toilet bowls. Our people are famous for making toilet bowls, I whispered to my dad. He stared straight ahead, trying not to laugh. Well, it's a good business, you know, he whispered back. Everybody has to shit. Later on, my husband actually said, that should have been the title of your book. It's more direct. It was hard to ignore the poverty that was all around us, however. Streets were in dismal condition, filled with potholes, and all along these streets were buildings that had been half-constructed and then abandoned. Toilet bowls then seemed to be creating a real business boom for our people. After about 40 minutes of lurching through traffic, just after we passed a gaggle of women squatting in a canal by the side of a large main road, ankle-deep in water as they scrubbed away at clothing, we pulled up to a tiny road, a narrow sliver that would wend its way to the heart of my ancestral village. We had an English-speaking guide whom the villagers had found to help us. My name is Fiona, she had said tentatively. I said, hello, I am Rulian. I can speak Mandarin. She looked a little relieved. Now, the next day, the village would hold its annual celebration to honor its ancestors. And Fiona, as the chief and the elders got down to the business of planning the festivities, we set about exploring the town. Do you know much Teochew? Fiona asked. I confess that I didn't. Well, she added, the Teochew that's spoken in your village is known as a particular kind of Teochew. It's very soft and tender. People say it's like listening to lovers' whispers. I thought back to the Teochew I'd grown up learning. I knew how to wish my parents Happy New Year, and I knew how to swear. Neither of these sounded remotely like lovers' whispers. I decided I would try to speak as little Teochew as possible while I was there. Soon enough, it was time for lunch, and back into the village chief's car we got. I found myself suddenly resentful of his relative wealth and girth after seeing the poverty in his village. And our meal turned out to be another several courser featuring pricey soups, fish, and seafood in a private room on the outskirts of town. We piled into a restaurant's private room, exhausted after a long morning walking around the dusty village. The head gestured to us to seat ourselves, and I started toward a chair in the corner when my father pulled me aside. You know, he whispered, in China, the most senior person at the meal sits facing the door. In all the meals that we'd had in China, two of which the village head himself had attended, that prime seat had been the one that I had taken. In fact, it was the one that I had been making a beeline for when my father saved me. Shamed, I vowed instantly to be more sensitive, more subservient, as an obedient Chinese daughter should be, for the remainder of the trip, anyway. I was beginning to feel like I wasn't quite fitting in with everything. Earlier that day, in fact, Michael had taken me aside. Today, he said, you must call everyone Achek or Laochek, okay? Uncle and senior uncle, of course. I was chagrined that I had forgotten such basic niceties. It turned out I also needed to tame the outgoing journalist in me, fade into the background a little, and let my father be the first to shake everyone's hand. Also at lunch that day, a bottle of whiskey was opened and shared. Even Fiona and I were offered small amounts. There was much laughter, storytelling, and many, many toasts. I thought things were going well, and I raised my glass several times, clinking it with my Acheks and Laocheks. Once again, however, my father whispered to me, when you toast someone older than you, your glass needs to be lower than his as a sign of respect. Of course, in the many toasts that I had shared, this was not the case. I began to wonder what they must think of this unruly Americanized female, and I also questioned whether I had any real connection with this place that had been my ancestors' home. Just then, however, the conversation steered toward Barack Obama. As the chatter took a slightly negative turn, someone stopped, gesturing toward me and shushing the others because they might be offending the New York girl. Immediately, however, one of the Acheks said, I know she is American, but she still has black hair, he said in Teochew. She is still Chinese. Thank you.
I'd very much like to thank Cheryl. Wonderful. And the books are being sold in the lobby, and you'll be here to sign them personally. I'd like to thank the Consulate General for and the wonderful lunch that we had. I just enjoyed the drink, which was fabulous, and the cookies, wonderful. Thank you so very much for sharing all of these wonderful treats with us this afternoon. At this point, the meeting is adjourned.